Welcome, everyone. My name is Samir Kakodkar. I'm a gastroenterologist and specialist in ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Welcome to Against the Grain. If you enjoy this interview, please do check out the rest of my podcasts, which can be found at the website samir3.podomatic.com, or you can search my first and last name either in YouTube or Twitter, and you can find more information there. If you have any questions or comments about this podcast and you want to reach me directly, you can email me at samir3@gmail.com. Dr. Mitsuro Chiba is an MD, PhD gastroenterologist and researcher at Akita City Hospital in Japan. He believes that inflammatory bowel disease is a lifestyle disease mediated mainly by a westernized diet and has many subsequent publications detailing his use of a plant-based diet. He began using this diet for patients with inflammatory bowel disease at Nakadori General Hospital in 2003 and then continued to provide the diet at Akita City Hospital since 2013. We had a very detailed discussion regarding his well-cited paper, Lifestyle-Related Disease in Crohn's Disease, Relapse Prevention by a Semi-Vegetarian Diet, published in 2010, which demonstrated the efficacy of using a plant-based diet in combination with infliximab, otherwise known as Remicade, for induction of remission, then maintenance with a plant-based diet. Though Dr. Chiba's English is excellent, special thanks to Dr. Chiba's daughter, Keiko, who helped with translation at certain points of the interview. This podcast should not be interpreted as medical advice, as a plant-based diet is not FDA approved for the treatment of Crohn's or colitis.
Thank you very much for inviting me to sit for this interview. It will be fun to talk with you and an IBD specialist about common topics in IBD. If you speak a little bit slowly, I should be able to understand what you are asking. If I want to explain a complicated matter, I will use an interpreter, my daughter. Okay?
Great.
How is weather in Chicago? I sometimes have a report in Chicago, blizzard in Chicago, and it caused a lot of problem in your city.
Yeah, thank you for asking. It's actually very cold here. It's snowing as we speak, and it can be a difficult thing to deal with, going through traffic, getting to work. How about in Japan? And what city of Japan are you calling us from?
Well, it's Akita City. It's a northern part of main island.
Wow.
And it's well-known snow country. But this year, in Japan, all over the world, all over in Japan, it's very mild, and we don't have snow now. Mm. It's extraordinary rare season.
Mm. Yeah, maybe it's the global warming, climate change. Even in Chicago, it's been milder than it usually has in years past, as far as the temperature and snow. So, great. So, welcome, Dr. Chiba. I'm happy we are finally able to have this interview. This is really going to be a trans-global exchange of ideas regarding dietary management of Crohn's and colitis. And this is an element of the treatment that is not being discussed, at least in a mainstream way, in all of the conferences, at least in the U.S., that are deal with inflammatory bowel disease. It's kind of on the periphery. The main discussion still is medication and surgery. So your perspective is really going to be a fresh one, and one that the U.S. really needs to hear, definitely because you're well-published in this area. So can you briefly describe your training background and how you decided to focus on inflammatory bowel disease?
Okay. Well, I graduated from Hirosaki University School of Medicine in 1972. I wonder whether you were born at this time.
That was after, yeah.
My professor at the Department of Gastroenterology was a pioneer of ulcerative colitis in Japan. I was posted to IBD group. In those days, immunology was fashion. The title of my thesis of PhD was Cell-Mediated Immunity in Ulcerative Colitis. I was a research fellow at Mayo Clinic from 1978 to 79. I characterized isolated gut mucosal lymphoid cells. Then I studied putative microbial agent in Crohn's disease at New Mexico University School of Medicine from 1979 to 81. After 3 years studying in the United States, I returned to Japan. Our group in Akita University was involved in immunohistology on gut tissue, including HLA DR antigen. I studied a putative microbial agent in Crohn's disease, Mycobacterium paratuberculosis, at St. George's Medical School in London during a sabbatical leave from 1994 to 1995. But I could not be produced to isolate Mycobacterium paratuberculosis in Crohn's disease. I tried to identify bacterial 16S RNA in gut lymph follicle. No single bacterium, but various bacteria was identified in IBD lymph follicle. At this point, I tended to think that gut microbiota rather than single microbial agent was responsible for IBD. In 22, I published in Japanese, IBD is thought to be lifestyle disease mediated mainly by westernized diet. And I began to provide a plant-based diet for patients with IBD at Nakadori General Hospital, Akita City, Japan, in the following year, 2023, and then continued to provide the diet at Akita City Hospital since 2013. That's my career.
Mm. Very, very impressive. I was not aware that you were involved in some of the work trying to isolate Mycobacterium avium paratuberculosis as the cause of Crohn's. Did you by chance work with Professor John Herman Taylor? Because I know he's very involved in that and trying to develop a Crohn's vaccine. So what was your experience in that realm?
Well, I visited that institution and I had a guidance of Dr. Herman Taylor, but I couldn't reproduce their isolation results.
So there are certain people who use combinations of antibiotics targeting this MAP bacteria for Crohn's, and the results have been mixed. Some of the studies show an initial response, but not a sustained response over time. I'm just curious, what is your opinion about using these cocktails of antibiotics to target the MAP bacteria?
Well, you know, I couldn't reproduce their results.
Mm-hmm.
So you know what I think about those.
Sure. Yeah, I guess that means you probably think that is not a major cause of Crohn's. So what do you think is the cause of Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, and how does diet play into that cause?
Epidemiology shows that IBD is prevalent in wealthy nations where dietary westernization inevitably occurs. This general rule was reported by NIH Working Group on Arteriosclerosis of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute in 1981. Dietary westernization is an increased consumption of animal protein, animal fat, and sugar, with a decreased consumption of grains. A dietary study during dietary transition in Japan incriminated an increased intake of animal fat and animal protein to an increase in Crohn disease. Pre-illness case control studies, including those in Japan, have reported increased sugar intake, fat, fast food, chocolate, and cola drinks in IBD, and a decrease in total fruit and vegetable fiber in Crohn's disease. Case control studies in Japan are consistent. Western foods, including bread, are risk factor, while traditional Japanese foods are preventive factor. The same tendency was repeatedly reported. A positive association with a Western diet, meat, fatty acids, and desserts, and an inverse association with a prudent diet, vegetables, fruits, olive oil, grains, and nuts. Diets rich in animal protein and animal fat cause a decrease in beneficial bacteria in the intestine. These pieces of evidence are consistent with the notion that a westernized diet is linked to an increase in IBD. Therefore, we regard IBD as a lifestyle disease mediated by mainly a westernized diet. Consequently, if a suitable diet is identified and patients stick to the diet, we believe that majority of IBD patients could be free from relapse without medication.
That is a perspective that's not at least widely held in the U.S.
Right.
So that's why I think it's very important we're discussing this now, and we really want to get into the details of why you believe this and your experience over the many years you've been implementing this diet. Why does westernization, this pattern that you just described, why does that occurring globally, especially as countries gain more wealth? The wealthier a country becomes, they tend to eat this pattern that you just described, more animal protein, more animal fat, more processed food, less fruits and vegetables. Why is that happening?
Well, it's a natural habit, depending upon economic. So we say the economic transition follows nutritional followed by nutritional transition. It is a general rule everywhere in the world. It is clearly described in 1981 by NIH report.
Yeah, I think from my perspective, I think it's just tastier. I think people like the taste of this westernized type of way of eating. It really targets, you know, the high sugar, high fat content of food. The heavily processed food seems to be palatable, easier for people to eat the food because it comes in boxes, jars, cans, and already ready prepared. So this type of pattern, I can see why it would be popular, as people have more money to spend. So can you, and you've been seeing IBD patients for a long time in Japan, so can you give us a sense of the rise in the incidence of IBD in Japan? Like when you were in training, when you were in medical school, or even if you remember in childhood, was there a lot of IBD in Japan around, or is your sense is that it's really increasing, accelerating, exploding year by year? So if you can give us a sense of that landscape of IBD in Japan.
I can add why people like westernized diet. You know, Japanese is shorter than, not taller than westernized people are tall and look strength. Mm-hmm. And people wanted to be more strength person.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I will talk that epidemiology in Japan. Mm-hmm. Okay. Japanese economic growth started in the 1960s. There is a unique public medical aid system for intractable diseases, including IBD in Japan. Patients with intractable disease are provided with public medical aid upon registration at a public health office. We analyzed interrelation between annual number of new cases of IBD over the period from 1965 to 2000. And the daily amount of nutrient intake per capita revealed by the National Nutrition Survey. Rapid increase in estimated incidence per 100,000 population have been observed from 0.003 in 1965 to 1.3 in 2000 for Crohn disease, from 0.08 to 4.8 for UC, with extremely high correlation between the annual numbers of new cases of the respective diseases. Of all food groups, the intake of rice as a staple food showed the highest negative correlation coefficient with the number of new cases of both Crohn disease and UC, and showed a high negative correlation to intake of animal protein and animal fat. Therefore, we have submitted a paper titled Rapid Increase in Inflammatory Bowel Disease During Dietary Westernization in Japan in 2002. This was not accepted by the New England Journal of Medicine. In those days, submission was done not online, but by mailing a paper, and it took time to have a decision letter. To my regret, this paper was left alone. I would like to add recent data in Japan. The number of patients receiving public medical aid for UC and CD in Japan were 2,546 and 258, respectively, in 1977. These are 167,872 and 42,789, respectively, in 2016.
Wow.
These are 66-fold and 166-fold increases in UC and CD, respectively, during the past 40 years.
Wow, very dramatic increases, and I think that parallels the experience of other countries as well. That, yeah, it's just exploding worldwide. So, and you just mentioned that there was a negative correlation. Your initial submission to the New England Journal of Medicine several years ago, that paper you referenced, you said there was a negative correlation with the diagnosis of these diseases with rice, and then a positive correlation with animal fat and animal protein?
Right. That's why I recommend to have rice.
Right. The reason you included rice in your diet initially was because of this epidemiological study that you did. But just to comment that a lot of the other diets out there that people are using for IBD tend to exclude grains and rice. Not all of them, but most of them tend to do that. So that's something that makes your diet unique. So what do you think about physicians recommending low fiber or low residue diets for patients with inflammatory bowel disease who are having flares?
It's utterly wrong direction. Low residue diet do not have dietary fiber that make disease worse. It's not the right direction. But we saw, even though the low residue diet, patients recover from the disease. Yes, it was. But plant-based diet will surely recover patients rather than low residue diet.
Okay. So can you explain? So now let's get into this, the plant-based diet, your diet that you use for patients with Crohn's and colitis. Can you explain the theory behind developing your semi-vegetarian diet as detailed in your 2010 publication, with the title of which is Lifestyle-Related Disease and Crohn's Disease, Relapse Prevention by a Semi-Vegetarian Diet? So those that are listening out there, you can search that on the internet and you can see the study for yourself. But what made you decide to study this kind of diet in particular?
Okay. We designed a diet that hopefully increased the number of beneficial bacteria. Limited foods are known to increase beneficial bacteria, green tea and unrefined brown rice. However, most prebiotics are extracts of plant. Therefore, I thought that a vegetarian diet was suitable for IBD. We grow up drinking milk and eating eggs. Therefore, lacto-ovo vegetarian diet was thought to be fine. Considering that excessive restriction in foods could cause less acceptance. Fish was served once a week and meat once every 2 weeks, both at about a half of an average amount. Namely, a semi-vegetarian diet was thought to be appropriate.
Yeah, and we will later get into the more of the details, but of that diet. But you know, there is another vegan diet protocol that some people use in this country, and it's this based on this book called Self-Healing Colitis and Crohn's by Dr. David Klein. I was just wondering if you were at all aware of that book. Is that something that you've heard of before?
No,
haven't
no,
heard. Okay, that's fine. And then are you aware of the specific carbohydrate diet, which is a monosaccharide type of diet that is used by many people in the, you know, worldwide as well? Are you aware, have you been aware of that diet over the years?
I know that SCD. Mm-hmm. I repeatedly listen to your voice.
Oh, okay.
Podcaster. And but I read your article, of course.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. Yeah. So I just wanted to know the context, if you were aware of those diets, which I'm sure you have been, having treating IBD patients for so long and being in the research sphere before I was even born. So I'm not surprised about that. Is there a reason why you chose to focus on Crohn's disease rather than ulcerative colitis in your initial publication? In my opinion, I think diet, at least the specific carbohydrate diet and also exclusive enteral nutrition, dietary manipulation tends to work better in Crohn's, in my opinion, compared to ulcerative colitis. And we know that is the case for exclusive enteral nutrition, but was there a particular reason you focused this publication on Crohn's rather than UC?
Relapse following resumption of meal is quite common in Crohn's disease compared to ulcerative colitis. Therefore, Crohn's disease patients and the doctors thought meals make worse disease. If same vegetarian diet is good for Crohn's disease, same vegetarian diet should be good for UC too, because the same environmental factor acts in both diseases.
Makes sense. Yeah, okay. So in your experience, you felt like there was more of a relapse of disease when people were resuming eating in Crohn's rather than ulcerative colitis, and that's kind of the reason you tried to at least start with Crohn's, but it would make sense that it would work in both. If it works in Crohn's. Okay. So notably and if people want to read through the study, I encourage them to do that, and you can find it online pretty easily. I was able to find it on Google, actually, just searching your name. It's one of the first links that comes up, and it's there in full. But of the 22 patients in this study, remission was achieved with medications. In five of them, it was surgery for obstructions. So, you know, from the beginning, as you were designing this study, is there a reason you used medications up front to induce remission as opposed to just using diet by itself? Like, was this a deliberate choice? And was it back then, did you feel like diet wasn't enough initially to get things under control?
Well, 17 of 22 Crohn's disease patients achieved remission by medical treatment. All patients except for one case were administered infliximab. Mm-hmm. Standard infliximab induction therapy needs 6 weeks. This induction was administered in patient basis. The period of 6 weeks admission is not longer than those of therapy in prebiotic era in Japan. Even though endoscopic remission was confirmed in half of patients, one case administered sulfasalazine. You mentioned that some patients with CDAI more than 150, but normal CRP in our case series. I looked at table, but there is no such case. So. Okay. No placebo effect.
Okay. Yeah, that was the one thing I was going to ask next was, you know, nowadays, with at least the drug trials, there, you know, it used to be that the inclusion criteria to include a patient into a study for a drug was that they had to have a CD. It was mainly based on symptoms. They have a survey called the Crohn's Disease Activity Index that has mostly clinical parameters. There's I believe, a lab parameter in it as well, but it's mostly based on symptoms and kind of like a global physician assessment. And that gives you a number of points. And if you're less than 150, you're considered in remission. And then greater, you're considered to have, you know, active Crohn's. But subsequently, now the drug trials are trying to only include patients who have objective evidence of inflammation, that being an elevated CRP or, you know, elevated fecal calprotectin or endoscopic evidence, actually doing a colonoscopy and seeing inflammation. And the purpose of that is to avoid there being placebo effects, because there are some people with Crohn's or colitis who actually are in endoscopic remission but still have symptoms, still can feel terrible despite their disease being not active. And then if you put them on a medicine and they get better, it's unclear if it's actually treating the disease or it's just you know, again, like this placebo effect. Okay, so that's good to know. And we do know that some people with Crohn's don't even mount CRP, and it's not necessarily reliable by itself to let us know if there is active disease. So that was just the, you know, just playing devil's advocate. You know, one of the things some may say is that, oh, could these have been IBS symptoms? But it seems like from your perspective, you're pretty confident most of these people had really true active disease.
I think Crohn's disease is very intractable and frequent relapse. And I recognize all Crohn's disease except for 10 to 20% of Crohn's disease. They are very severe disease. Mm-hmm. That's why I initially induce remission by infliximab therapy. Average trial includes in more severe disease, but I included milder cases too for our protocol.
So you did use infliximab or Remicade as a major medicine to induce remission, but you gave them the loading, which is usually at initially, then 2 weeks later, then 4 weeks after that, and then subsequently stopped it. And I'm very interested in this decision because I don't think, and I'm actually glad you did that, because then we could truly see if the diet was maintaining remission in these patients as opposed to continuing them on maintenance therapy. But I can tell you, for to do such a study in this country, in the U.S., would be impossible nowadays, just because the concern about, you know, you have a potentially effective therapy, and then the risk of stopping the medicine and the risk of developing antibodies to the drug and it not being an option later on. So I'm glad this data exists and that you were able to do it so that we can really see the effect of the diet. So what was that a concern as you were designing this trial, knowing that potentially if these patients, if the diet didn't work and they needed to go back on medicine, it may, the Remicade may not work as well, or they may have a higher risk of developing antibodies and infusion reactions?
That's a basic difference between my view and the general view. What is the etiology of inflammatory bowel disease? The etiology of IBD is generally stated as unknown. Indeed, the precise mechanism is far from being clear. However, there are profuse data accumulated all over the world for nearly one century. Data on epidemiology, symptomatology, microbiology, immunology, pathology, genetics, and so on. My conclusion is that IBD is recognized as a lifestyle disease mediated mainly by a westernized diet. Therefore, a suitable diet replacing a westernized diet is the basis of treatment of IBD. In this context, dietary treatment or dietary intervention is not alternative medicine, but rather an orthodox approach to treatment. We regard IBD as a lifestyle disease mediated by mainly a westernized diet. Consequently, if a suitable diet is identified and patients stick to the diet, I believe that the majority of IBD patients could be free from relapse without medication. Therefore, it is quite natural for me to stop infliximab and observe whether relapse occurs by semi-vegetarian diet. This difference influenced the protocol for dietary intervention for IBD. We advise patients to continue a plant-based diet as lifestyle choice, while other interventions set certain periods for adherence to a recommended diet.
What do you think about using steroids instead of infliximab, potentially, because that is a medicine that you can start and stop without much of a consequence, and it doesn't really potentially burn that bridge with infliximab. Do you sometimes use steroids instead of medication or like a biologic to induce remission by it and then transition to the plant-based diet?
Well, that's why I use infliximab and plant-based diet as first-line therapy. So I don't use steroid before starting infliximab. I immediately provide IPF therapy upon diagnosis of Crohn's disease.
What do you mean by IPF?
Infliximab and plant-based diet.
Oh, okay. Okay.
First-line therapy, IPF therapy.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I mean, it's that we tend to jump to using steroids, at least in this country, in anybody who's having acute symptoms. And that may not necessarily be the right answer, because obviously the side effect profile of steroids is the worst of any of the medications. It also can inhibit protein synthesis. It's not necessarily very good at leading to mucosal healing. So a lot of patients out there who've had really bad experiences with steroids and being on them long term, I think would be very happy with your approach to do everything we can to avoid steroid use. And we know that infliximab induces remission by itself; it doesn't require steroids to use with it. So that's an interesting and makes sense why you wouldn't use that up front. So. Can you explain your plant-based diet to us as if we were patients under your care, as if we were in the hospital learning about this for the first time? How do you word this? How do you educate patients, and what should we be doing?
Well, the patient will provide with educational material on lifestyle diseases, healthy lifestyle habits, pathogenesis of IBD, and information on plant-based diet. Same vegetarian diet was initiated on the same day of the infusion of infliximab in medically treated patients because all patients had appetite. Rice in gruel is often served for ill patients in Japan, depending on the patient's condition, about 800 or 1100 kilocalories per day was given in the beginning. Rice was served either in gruel or in normal. Calories were gradually increased to a maximum of about 30 kilocalories per kilogram of standard body weight. Majority of Japanese eat white rice as a staple. Brown rice is uncommon and is generally not tasty compared to white rice. Therefore, white rice was served first for 2 to 5 days, followed by mixed rice, 70% white rice and 30% unrefined whole brown rice for 2 to 5 days. And finally, brown rice was served. Unrefined brown rice contains more vitamins and minerals than white rice and is reported to significantly increase beneficial bacteria compared to well-milled white rice. Crohn's disease is far more untenable than ulcerative colitis. Considering tenability, white rice, mixed rice, and brown rice is served for UC, vulnerable UC, and Crohn's disease, respectively. the amount of rice consumption is less than the half of that half century ago. Therefore, I do not think limitation in rice consumption. During hospitalization, patients were provided with answers to any questions that they had. A registered dietitian also visited the patients and talked to them about the plant-based diet and helped them get used to it. At the end of hospitalization, a qualified dietitian gave dietary guidance to the patient and the person who prepared patient's meal. Patients were advised to continue with the plant-based diet after discharge. In outpatient department, I mentioned to continuance of plant-based diet, but I do not check whether patient is really on plant-based diet. When I want to calculate plant-based diet score, I use food frequency questionnaire.
I do want to get into a little bit more of the nuts and bolts of the diet, the specifics of it. So just one of the statements. So you did say that rice, there's really no limit to rice, right? As much as the patient wants to eat, they're allowed to eat. They can eat it, you know, three meals a day, and that's fine from your perspective.
Well, nowadays, even Japanese don't eat much rice.
Okay.
So I do not need to mention the limitation of rice consumption.
Okay. Why is that? Why do they? Is it a concern about the glycemic index, about diabetes or weight or what?
Well, eating bread would be more easier for young people.
Okay. Oh, I guess it's just in general, it's the preference is not to eat much rice. Okay. So the patients remained admitted for 6 weeks. They were in the hospital for 6 weeks during the whole induction with the infliximab or Remicade. They were there the whole time. This is amazing because in the U.S., there is such a push to get patients out of the hospital. And this mainly is because of financial reasons from the hospital's perspective, because they most of the time make a certain amount of money based on a patient's diagnosis and the treatment, and not necessarily on a day by day, like how long a patient is in. So there's a big pressure to get patients out of the hospital when they feel like the rest of the treatment can be done on an outpatient basis at home. So how were you able to accomplish that? Is this something that you got any resistance from the hospital as far as keeping patients in the hospital for that long?
I mentioned that public aid for the cost for patients with IBD. So patients do not worry about the medical expense as people in your country. Mm-hmm. The system is different. And I mentioned before that the 6 week admission is not longer than that of admission in prebiotic era. Patients do not refuse my recommendation. Mm-hmm. There are some patients, the for example, I want to dismiss for a certain period for entrance examination. Mm-hmm. In that case, I administer two infusion of infliximab, and then patients discharge, and then readmit the for third infusion.
Okay.
That's flexible.
Okay. Now, I'm sure the patients are very appreciative of having that time in the hospital, because So does the kitchen in the hospital actually prepare your diet as in your protocol and provide the patients the meals for that full 6 weeks specifically to your protocol?
There are several different four-week menus on a rotational basis. Typical meals, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. This picture is in our paper.
I did see that. Yeah, if you guys who are listening actually go to his paper, and there is a picture of some of the meals that are in his protocol, so you should take a look at that. But yeah, go ahead.
And for Crohn's disease, boiled brown rice and miso soup, it's a fermented bean paste soup, are served three times, breakfast, lunch, and supper. There are another three or four dishes, but the name of foods are unfamiliar with listeners, and I'm afraid it is not useful for listeners. Well, I can read, of course.
Are these like Japanese names of foods, or?
Yes.
Okay, that's okay. You can say those names, and people can search and see what they are, and there may be people listening in Japan as well. So I think it still will be
okay
relevant.
First, okay, one dish, raw grated yam and shredded toasted nori seaweed. Second dish, fermented bean soybeans, natto in Japanese, grated Japanese radish. Third dish, hijiki seaweed, thick deep-fried bean curd, young soybeans. For lunch, boiled potato, onion, and corn in tomato soup. Second dish, dried nori sweet seaweed inside the egg roll and boiled chrysanthemum with sesame dressing. Third dish, pickled radish. Fourth dish, a mixture of banana and plain yogurt. For dinner, one dish, boiled chingensai, soybeans, wakame seaweed with vinegar, soy sauce dressing. Second dish, bean curd based mixture, bean curd, boiled egg, eggplant, butterball, pumpkin, and snow peas. Third dish, citrus fruits. Okay, and I add, in our semi-vegetarian diet, no food item is prohibited. Foods that have been shown to be a risk factor for IBD in or outside Japan, including sweets, bread, cheese, margarine, fast foods, carbonate beverages, and juices, were not prohibited but discouraged. You can eat meat, fish, cakes, and so on occasionally, not on the basis of lifestyle. Occasional intake of animal products will not disturb gut microbiota. I recommend fruits per se, namely apple, rather than apple juice. Neither infliximab nor plant-based diet is not indicated in cases with obstructive symptoms, in which surgery is indicated. Crohn's disease patients with stricture particularly the penetrating type with stricture, should be well informed about the risk of developing obstruction after IPF therapy and the need for surgery. Plant-based diet was initiated on the same day of the first infliximab infusion. We did not experience any adverse events of plant-based diet in 44 cases that received infliximab. We experienced more patients in ulcerative colitis, 170 patients. Again, I did not experience any adverse events of plant-based diet. The variety of diets based on cultural background forms the diversity of gut microflora. In addition, susceptible genes for IBD differ by ethnicity. Therefore, some food items of plant-based diet will differ from country to country. Our plant-based diet is to be modified and applicable worldwide.
I just want to go back to the specifics. You said sweets. So when you say sweets are discouraged, can you be a little bit more specific on what that would be? Do you mean mainly just like cookies, cakes, crack, like that type of thing, like actually processed sweets? Or would you also mean like eating 4 bananas in a day or eating a lot of sweet fruits? Is that discouraged?
Well, you know, the eating between meals is an unhealthy habit. So I don't recommend having some foods between meals. You know, the healthy habits reported by a researcher in 1988. I followed that, Breslow's healthy habits.
Okay.
I followed that rule.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What is it about eating between meals that is unhealthy? Is it because, you know, your gut needs rest in between meals in order to function properly? Is it a matter of circadian rhythm and clock genes and how they're regulated by timing of meals? What is it about about snacking that's bad?
Well, I think those you mentioned are responsible for healthy habits. And it is the reason is explained in the Breslow's reference.
Okay. Okay, yeah, I'll try to find that reference and include it in the episode notes in case people want to read more about that. And what about cheese? Is that all types of cheese because this is relevant because the specific carbohydrate diet, which a lot of people follow, does allow certain cheeses that are lactose-free, that have no lactose in them, and these would be the hard-aged cheeses like cheddar, Gouda, Swiss, things like that. But from your perspective, are any types of cheese okay, or is all cheese should be discouraged?
I'm not a nutritionalist.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know precisely, but there are papers describing that animal products, including cheese, are unhealthy. So that's why I don't recommend the animal products.
Okay. Okay, going more into that, the animal products and meat. So what types of meat are allowed? So you said patients can have fish once a week and other types of meat every other week, right? One serving every other week. But what specific types of meat are you okay with, and in what form? So let's start with fish. Like, what types of fish would be okay from your perspective?
Well, I haven't mentioned what kind of fish is all right, and there is no precise information for that okay. to the patient. Also, meat and fish are cooked by meal preparer, so in hospital, okay? And so I didn't ask dietitian what kind of fish or what kind of meat is preferable than others or not. Okay. I didn't mention anything.
Okay.
So it's a very rough instruction.
Okay. Okay.
Literature reference preferred to animal products, fish would be good, then birds, chicken, and then sheep, and the last beef. You know that.
Okay. So in that order, so fish would be okay for once a week, and then chicken and other birds and beef would be, you know, at most once every other week.
Right.
And you know, and the reason I bring up these specifics is for patients who are following these diets, a lot of them do like want this kind of specific information, and some of the diets do offer it and some don't, and it may, in the grand scheme of things, may not be important, but some people interpret fish as different things. Like what I'm getting from it is it should be, you know, good quality fish, you know, not going to, for example, McDonald's and getting a fish fillet, like some deep fried piece of fish in that's fried in flour, or even a lot of these processed smoked type of fish products that you get from the store, but more freshly prepared without, you know, all the marinades that come with it, with good quality ingredients, is what I would consider an appropriate fish. So, yeah, I don't know if you had any words about that. As far as, I think there can be some misinterpretation. Like somebody could eat a fish stick, which in this country is like you buy that frozen at the store, and it's coated in, you know, corn or some sort of flour and deep fried, and has probably 100 other ingredients in them that are preservatives. And somebody may mistakenly assume that that's okay to eat. So if you could say a few words about that.
So, he says, probably in Japan, when the nutritionist in the hospital, when they talk about fish and meat, we assume that it's a good quality fish and meat. And we do understand that, like, for example, McDonald's in Japan, we also give a very, a frozen, a lot of flowers coated
right.
Fish. But at the moment in Japan, he doesn't feel that it's quite a lot of readers assume when they say fish and meat is more like a good quality
okay.
as is. But he also believe in the future, if there's need a guidance for more details like that, maybe for overseas patient, it should be as written in details.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm.
And okay. What is your policy about eggs? How do eggs play into it? What is that something somebody can have also every other week, or what is the frequency allowed for that?
Well, lacto, ovo, semi-vegetarian. Lacto means milk, ovo means eggs. So lacto, ovo, vegetarian diets, eggs is allowed, no restriction.
Okay. And so milk, is milk allowed too?
Yes.
Okay, so is there any particular type of milk that is preferred, cow's milk or goat's milk, or is it just...
I don't mention precisely
specifics.
Yes,
okay.
Okay.
How do you feel, and this may, you may not have specifics about this either, but is the fruits and vegetables that are served in the hospital during this induction period, are they organic? Do you know, or is that something that's done in the hospital? Is this organic produce that's being used?
I haven't asked the dietitian about that, but I asked the rice whether it, because brown rice is exposed to chemical agents, would not be good.
What about dietary supplements? Do you think these are necessary as somebody is on this diet? I want to give some context behind this because there is some resistance to using dietary therapies in the U.S. because there's this fear that these patients are already malnourished, they're already lost a lot of weight, and to put them on any kind of restriction, physicians here get afraid of that because there's this fear they're going to lose even more weight and then get certain nutritional deficiencies. So in your experience, having used this for so long, do you recommend supplements, and is that a valid fear to have?
Yes. There is a requirement of some supplements when you advise vegan. But it's a semi-vegetarian diet, and animal meats every 2 weeks and fish once a week. I have no problem in patient nutrition and no side effects, no worry about the nutritional deficiency. So I don't recommend the supplement.
What about these food additives, these texturizers, these preservatives, these kind of microparticles in the food, such as things like carrageenan, maltodextrin, carboxymethylcellulose, titanium dioxide, polysorbates, sodium caprate? There's a large list of things that are put in certain processed foods that are known to lead to, you know, dysbiosis and potentially damaging the gut barrier. Are these things you counsel patients on, or is it not so important in your opinion?
So far at the moment, with his data and information, he can't 100% sure that these kind of addings that you commented about are not affecting the IBD.
Okay.
So he doesn't give any kind of guidance towards it to his patient.
Okay. Which grains are allowed besides rice or any other types of grains? You mentioned bread, so my assumption is you are excluding bread. What about things like pasta, quinoa, white flour, wheat? Should people avoid those?
So Dr. Chiba mainly just comment to eat rice. He doesn't give. And also, he mentioned about udon.
Okay.
As an alternative.
And what about the sushi rice? And just sushi in general? Because it seemed like as long as it's limited, you know, once a week, it would probably be okay. But my understanding is they add sugar to the rice in sushi rice. Maybe I'm mistaken, but I remember seeing that on a cooking show once. But is sushi okay from your perspective?
Well, sushi is covered by fish. So once a week, it would be all right. And sushi and sugar, it is not common in Japan.
And then your opinion about gluten-free. Gluten-free, you know, there's been some research to show that perhaps that can lead to the gluten can upregulate zonulin and lead to leaky gut. Some people think that's a real phenomenon, other people don't. So any thoughts on this gluten, being gluten-free and eating grains that are labeled as gluten-free?
In Japan, gluten-free, gluten disease is extremely rare.
Okay.
So I haven't thought of that.
Okay. There is another diet called the IBDA diet. Barbara Olensky through the University of Massachusetts, who I did do a podcast interview with her as well, and her diet does include it includes oatmeal, steel-cut oatmeal. Is oatmeal something that's regularly consumed in Japan, and it seems at least consistency-wise similar to brown rice? So just curious about if you had any specific thoughts about oatmeal.
Well, oatmeal is not common in Japan. I have never had oatmeal in Japan.
Okay, fair enough, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would think it seems pretty similar to brown rice as far as the texture of it, and it is also it's thought to be gluten-free as well, as rice is too. So which particular sweeteners are allowed? Or any guidance about that? In the specific carbohydrate diet, they pretty much only allow honey as a sweetener. But in your opinion, I know generally sweets are discouraged, but using sugar or using these artificial sweeteners like sucralose or aspartame, and some people use stevia, or even agave syrup, these different types of sweeteners, what is your opinion about that?
Well, again, I don't have much knowledge about that, so I didn't mention to patients.
Okay. I think this is important to know, because it must not be that important of a factor if this, you know, specific guidance wasn't given regarding sweeteners and some of the other things I mentioned, and your patients still did well. So, of course, the dietary pattern of your patients in Japan is different from how we eat in the U.S. as far as what the baseline is in the Western diet here. So it'll be interesting to see with your general guidelines as far as this is how you should eat. I think it would actually be implemented differently amongst the patients you see in Japan and the patients that I see. Because I can just give you, for example, if I told a patient I saw, and this is not everybody, but some patients would, if I told them you should eat fish once a week, meat every every other week, and rice is allowed, and you know, fruits and vegetables encouraged, something of that nature. Without specifics, they may end up going to buying a pack of Skittles and eating some Doritos and thinking that's a plant-based diet, when in reality, I'm sure that's not what you're advocating. So I think there is a little bit of a cultural divide that needs to be bridged as far as I think the patients in the U.S. need more specifics, because they're operating in a landscape where the food is so toxic all around them. And it's very difficult to find fresh fruits and vegetables, produce, in a lot of the cities in the U.S., and they really have to go out of their way to find this kind of food.
Our patients are admitted, and our patients are served whole dishes, breakfast, lunch, and supper. And I think patients learn what it is they are like during admission. And if patients have some question, they ask to dietitian. I don't know precisely that. So the how to cook or how to choose the certain foods would ask probably to dietitian, I guess.
Sure. But I think it's great that you give them these meals over that time period, because that is almost most of the education probably occurs by just seeing what they're supposed to be eating. This is the style of food they should eat, eating it. And certainly the response they get, according to your data, that people were doing well with this, that's education enough that they should stay on this diet, because it seems to work for them. But I think that is the best education, is giving them the food that they need to eat and have them eat it. And I wish we could do that in this country. I've thought about potentially starting like a center where people with inflammatory bowel disease just come for even like 3 months at a time, and all the food is provided for them so that they can, that element of preparing the food all the time. And, you know, a lot of these patients are too sick to even prepare food for themselves. And having that family support is not always guaranteed to prepare these meals. So to have a place where they could just get the meals provided for them, at least initially, so they can get used to this lifestyle, I think is very helpful. And I really hope insurance companies listen to this. At least in this country, you know, that diet is not on any of their radars, but your results showing that people can get off biologics, which are very expensive medicines and are costing insurance companies a lot of money, and we get a lot of resistance from them as far as prescribing them to patients. This approach really should be seriously looked at globally, you know. And I'm very appreciative that you're sharing this information with us today. So, you know, getting off the specifics of the diet, and it seems like I think we have a good idea now of the general recommendations of the diet. So, and one sticking point, though, one thing that a lot of people are interested in is the yogurt. You know, the specific carbohydrate diet specifies a lactose-free yogurt. And in your diet, it seems like you do serve yogurt daily. Any sense of, you know, any specifics about that, or any yogurt is okay?
Yogurt means yogurt. Oh, yeah. I advise plain yogurt and not drink yogurt. And plain yogurt, and the cheapest one I recommend.
Okay, and does it have to be lactose free, or does that matter?
I don't know then.
It probably isn't. Most commercial yogurts are not lactose free. It has to be, you know, prepared in a certain way. So that's good to know. So your patients are probably doing well on just yogurt that is regularly available at the store. So have you noticed some issues with patients transitioning to this plant-based diet and having more bloating or gas? Because that can tend to happen and would almost be expected with any time you introduce more fiber in the diet. Is that something you've seen?
No, I don't see that.
Okay. Okay, that's good to know, because there are, especially when we recommend increasing fiber in the diet with respect to constipation, that is something, at least I've observed, is that people get a little bit more bloating. That tends to be temporary. It tends to go away over time. And certain vegetables have been associated with worsened symptoms in these epidemiological studies, and that's symptoms, not necessarily inflammation, but cruciferous vegetables like cauliflower or like cabbage can cause more bloating and distension and discomfort. So do those vegetables play an important role in your diet and are included, or like, yeah, things like cauliflower and cabbage?
Well, they are included in our meals. But I think another matter would be quantity of such foods. In general, the hospital meals use that, but very small quantities, I guess.
Okay. And do you know what kind of cooking oils are used? Is that an important part? Because there is at least, again, epidemiological studies looking at the mix of omega-3 and omega-6 and how in having a higher omega-6 to omega-3 ratio of fats in the diet may be pro-inflammatory. And some of the vegetable oils we use are higher in omega-6. So does that play a role at all in your protocol?
I didn't specify the oil.
Okay.
To a dietitian. And the dietitian didn't ask me what oil should be used. And You can fish.
And then also the Japanese typical cooking, we don't use a lot of oil, so it's not that significant.
Okay.
Because the quantity is very small for every meal.
Okay.
Probably.
I can add the difference of serving. In Japan, the vegetables are always cooked, not in raw. And I see the difference of serving of vegetables. Hmm. So Japanese eat vegetables cooked.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. So there's not many people eating like raw salads. So why do you think the plant-based diet enhances the efficacy of infliximab or Remicade for induction of remission? Why do you think that combination is more potent than just doing infliximab by itself?
That point, okay. Edding, K et al. From France reported the relation between biologics response and changes in the intestinal microbiome in IBD in journal Gastroenterology at the end of the last year. Infliximab and adalimumab therapy shifted the diversity of fecal microbiota toward that of healthy controls. Diversity indices were similar between responders and primary non-responders. In contrast, levels of butyrate and substances involved in butyrate synthesis in fecal samples were significantly reduced in primary non-responders as compared with responders both before and after treatment. Therefore, they stated that butyrate serves as a clinical marker for discrimination of responders and primary non-responders. Butyrate is well known as a key substance in maintaining homeostasis, including nutrition, immunology, and mucosal barrier function. Because butyrate is produced by bacterial fermentation of dietary fiber, the observation is interpreted as follows. Insufficient supply or consumption of dietary fiber in primary non-responders. Therefore, it is reasonable to speculate that an adequate diet with sufficient dietary fiber, like plant-based diet, rather than omnivorous diet, will decrease the rate of or prevent primary non-responders to infliximab. In fact, our modality incorporated plant-based diet together with infliximab as first-line therapy for Crohn's disease did not experience any primary non-responders to infliximab in 46 consecutive cases. We initiate plant-based diet on the same day of infliximab infusion. I think gut is tough more than we think.
I do think this combination of medication and diet, that's been always my perspective, that doing both is going to be more potent than using either one or the other. But definitely to use that infliximab to kind of induce remission quickly and help heal the mucosa, and that will allow, when you're introducing more of the fiber in the plant-based diet, allow more production of this butyrate that does have these immunomodulatory effects and is the energy source of the colon cells. So that I think that combination is very potent. On follow-up of these patients, after they left the hospital, you decided to put them on either sulfasalazine or mesalamine, which I think was a great choice because that is another strength of the study, because those medicines, for the most part, we don't think they're better than placebo in maintaining remission in Crohn's. On an anecdotal basis, I've seen patients who have superficial appearing Crohn's inflammation in the colon that almost looks like ulcerative colitis, but is considered Crohn's best based on pathology or distribution of disease that do well on mesalamine. But technically speaking, compared to placebo, mesalamine is not supposed to be good for maintenance of remission. So despite that, they still continue to do well with just the plant-based diet. Did that enter into your decision as far as using sulfasalazine or mesalamine for maintenance phase?
I noticed that in efficacy of five ASA compared to placebo, after that, I tend to not prescribe five ASA than before. And initial protocol, I prescribe metronidazole first for 3 weeks and switch to 5-ASA in Crohn's disease. But there is sometimes the adverse event occurs using 5-ASA. So it is, of course, stop the 5-ASA at that point. And so now I am very confident to stop 5-ASA if patients have some side effect.
Yeah, so just for the listeners, 5-ASA, you mean 5-ASA, right? Mesalamine, another name for mesalamine. So do you still, to this day, are you still putting them on mesalamine in the maintenance phase? I mean, outside of the study, in your clinical practice, are you putting them on 5-ASA after they get infliximab and then only stopping it if they have an intolerance to it or a side effect? Or are you not using it at all anymore?
Well, I'm using when it's continuing because the patients will have some discomfort if I stop suddenly.
Okay.
And so if there is a patient request to stop the medication, well, I agree with that, and I stop the medication.
I see. Okay. So can you briefly tell us the long-term, you know, it seems like you have data up to 2 years and the maintenance results of this diet. So what happened after patients left the hospital and were on this plant-based diet?
Okay. I already published our outcomes in the active and the quiescent stages in both Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. The final paper I intended to write is about the possibility of alteration of the natural cause of Crohn's disease. The lifelong relapse-free rate in Crohn's disease is 10 to 15%. In our series, namely IPF therapy, infliximab, and plant-based diet as first-line therapy, the relapse-free rate without maintenance infliximab therapy in initial case of adult Crohn's disease is 71% at 1 year. In my paper in 2010, it was 100%, but it decreased now, okay? And the subjects are different. This is a initial case of adult Crohn's disease, excluding the pediatric Crohn's disease. 71% at 1 year, 66% at 2 years, 56% at 3 years, and 51% after 4 years. They keep CRP normal. Of course, our sample size is very small, N equals 26. Therefore, it is too early to reach a conclusion. Some patients return to an omnivorous diet and gain body weight, resulting in obesity. but relapse doesn't occur. This suggests early induction of Crohn's disease by IPF therapy as a possible cure for Crohn's disease in a subset of Crohn's disease patients. So I'd like to watch the course of these patients.
Wow, that's fascinating. So there is a subset of patients who did very well on this diet and getting just induction with infliximab, stopping the infliximab after 6 weeks, then subsequently went back to eating the way they were eating before and did not have any relapse of Crohn's, but then became obese or gained weight. So what you're saying is that there may be a subset of people who really the disease goes away potentially. And as you said, I guess we'll have to wait for longer-term data to see if that stays the case. The one counterpoint I would make to that, and this is just playing devil's advocate, trying to think of what are the counterarguments of it. There have been studies on relapse of disease after stopping, like for people who've had mucosal healing on infliximab and subsequently stop the medication. There is a subset of those people who do remain well despite not getting any dietary therapy at all in induction or in the maintenance phase. But these are more people who've been on infliximab for a few years or so and are healed. And there is a subset of those people who do not relapse and don't do anything really with their diet. I believe roughly the numbers... I can't say off the top of my head. I mean, roughly about 50% at 2 years or so. I think those were more patients who were on combination therapy and may stop one of them. But there is some data on infliximab by itself and stopping it and seeing what the relapse rate is. That relapse really does increase over the years. But anyway, I mean, your results are definitely impressive. And it is an intriguing idea. Are some of these people cured? Is it possible? So do you ever use this plant-based diet along with other medications? Some of the newer ones that have come out, like vedolizumab, ustekinumab, tofacitinib. Do you have any experience with the possible synergy with these other meds too?
Fortunately, people are in good condition. So I don't really need that the biologics rather than Remicade and Humira. But I used one case, Stelara, Eutexinumab, and I haven't had chance of using vedolizumab, golimumab.
And you've also been you've recently published some results on it, or maybe in press about a study using infliximab for severe steroid refractory ulcerative colitis along with the plant-based diet.
Yeah.
And if you could just briefly share some of the results of that.
Yeah. Okay. The severe UC develops in 10 to 25% of UC patients. It is potentially life-threatening disease with 1% mortality rate. Therefore, treatment requires hospitalization. First-line therapy is intensive intravenous corticosteroids. Around 1/3 of the patients are unresponsive to the steroids. Infliximab or cyclosporine is used as rescue second-line treatment for patients unresponsive to the corticosteroid. This rescue therapy is currently unsuccessful in around 11 to 20% of patients, resulting in colectomy. When remission is successful induced with the infliximab, scheduled maintenance with infliximab is recommended. Nevertheless, some cases require colectomy, and the colectomy rates increase to around 26 to 37% at 1 year. We administered IPF therapy, not for steroid refractory patients, but for new severe patients. The remission rate was 76%, 13 cases of 17 cases. And the colectomy rate was 6%, 1 of 17 cases in the induction phase. At 1 year follow-up, there were no additional cases of colectomy. These results are better than those of current practice. This is IPF therapy for severe UC.
Great. Yeah, those are very encouraging results, and I'm sure we'll see more from you in that regard. That is a trouble area. You know, people who come in with very severe ulcerative colitis who are facing colectomy, and anything we can do to enhance the effect of infliximab is welcome and should be studied more. I know we're running short on time, so I just had one more question for you, Dr. Chiba. Again, thank you for making time for this. This has been very valuable, and it's just going to open up your research to a lot of different countries that may not be aware, and hopefully your protocol can be adapted to many other countries as well. But so how has your protocol been received by the gastroenterology community in Japan? Are you the only person who's implementing this, or have you gotten a lot of resistance from other GI doctors and other researchers, or are they open to your approach and utilizing it?
Well, unfortunately, you know, the randomized controlled trial is recognized very important in mm-hmm. journals. So I submit my paper, well then usually rejected.
Mm.
That's unfortunate. That's why I appreciate that the permanent journal accept our papers frequently, and single group trial is they review even in single group study. That's, I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Have you had any thoughts about doing a randomized control trial on with your protocol? It's very difficult to do with dietary studies as far as getting a control diet to use, but has that been something you've considered potentially doing in the future, a randomized controlled trial?
I don't intend the randomized control. You know, I am old, and you know, there is a pharmaceutical company support this kind of study.
Right.
So I'd like to mention
sure.
that we have shown far better outcomes in IBD therapy by replacing a westernized diet with plant-based diet. Granted, the evidence level of our single group study is low compared to RCT. As you know, however, not only the short term, but also the long-term effects of a suitable diet for IBD will need to be demonstrated. As such, it will take another decade to confirm the most suitable diet for IBD. I am concerned about clinical practice. Most gastroenterologists and other healthcare professionals providing care to IBD patients do not appreciate the critical role of diet in IBD. It is natural due to the lack of reasonable efficacy demonstrated in dietary intervention studies. Considering the large number of suffering patients due due to inappropriate dietary guidance. I believe recommendation of plant-based diet based on available evidence as next best is adequate and will provide great benefit to IBD patients. In this context, I appreciate your interview with me very much.
Dr. Chiba, thank you so much for your time. That I do, you know, it's unfortunate that you're submitting your research, and these journals need to realize that dietary research is difficult to do in the form of high quality evidence, especially if the funding, yeah, as you said, pharmaceutical companies provide most of the funding to do randomized controlled trials for drugs, and it's hard. So they should be open to this, but I'm glad we were able to shine a light on your research and your perspective and get the message out all over the world. Thank you so much. And I've been reading your papers over the many years that you've been publishing, and you know, as you said, even before I was born, you've been in this field. So I'm very grateful for your time, and thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.